From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Political candidates and the interest groups that love them broke advertising records this year for spending. $390 million, to be exact, $25 million since Labor Day alone. That's a lot of hay for 30-second zingers tonight on Point, assessing whether or not they got bang for their buck. You decide.
Investor confidence shaken, pensions in jeopardy. Well, one person is doing something about it, Tim Hutchinson. First, Tim wrote the Pension Security Act.
Hello, I'm a teacher here to see Governor Davis.
I'm sorry, you haven't given enough money to see Governor Davis.
I'd like to meet with Governor.
With Jeb Bush, leadership means results. 450,000 new jobs, the second highest job growth in the country.
The lowest. All right, open it up.
It's like asking Jesse James to guard a bank.
Washington all but opened the vault, looked the other way, and let greedy executives steal our savings. Congress caved into special...
Saxby Chambliss needs to be in the United States Senate. He's been in the Oval Office to give me sound, solid advice. He's somebody who goes to Washington...
Tim Johnson now admits flying all around the world on corporate junkets paid for by big special interests. How does he explain? Tim Johnson doesn't call them corporate junkets. He calls them corporate trade missions. Florida, Hong Kong, the Isle of Crete. Johnson even said to fight for lower drug prices, he had to take a trip to a posh resort in Puerto Rico paid for by the big drug companies. Typical politician. Ask Tim Johnson to cool his jets and start thinking about us for a change.
So there they are. Have the ads sunk in, or have you switched them off? Can Election Day not get here fast enough, if only because the ads will go away? Or do you rely on political advertising to help shape your opinion of political candidates? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Daniel Payne, founder and president of Payne and Company and a Democratic consultant to candidates and nonprofit organizations. Good evening and welcome, Dan Payne.
Good evening.
Good to have you. Also joining me in the studio tonight is Todd Domke, Republican media consultant and author, most recently of Cain and Abel at Work. Thanks for being here, Todd Domke.
Good to be with you.
So we're going to hear a lot of ads tonight from right across the country, kind of take an audio tour, if you will. But I guess before we even dive into that, Dan, give us your view first. Are we getting more sophisticated every time we come to an election? Is there evolution in what we hear in political ads on television?
Well, I think people are demanding better production values, spicier kinds of fare, schmaltzy stuff that used to accompany early use of TV in campaigns has really kind of fallen by the wayside. Candidates always try to do some family-oriented spots, but rather than being the main thrust of a campaign, they're now a minor part of what's done. I do think candidates are also almost forced by the news media, if not the other campaigns, to attack or compare. It's become expected.
Forced by the news media. Do you mean they'll be called wimps if they don't?
That, and they're also, the news media frequently learns things from TV spots, and they expect you to tell them what's wrong with the other guy.
So plant the ugly information. Todd Domke, do you agree? Is it the media that's egging on these things, or do you as a consultant, Republican or Democrat, come in and say, you've got to go negative and go negative now?
Well, it's less that the media are egging on the campaigns to do it. I think it's more that there is less news coverage of political campaigns, and so therefore, for candidates to get their message to the voters, they do have to buy the time. If you look at television news in most media markets, over not just in the last few years, but over decades, there's been a continuing trend where less and less time is given to political news coverage.
So it's invisible unless they raise that big money and get their ads up on air themselves.
That's right. But it's also there is, I would say, more cynicism in the news coverage in that a lot of reporters and editors and producers come to the conclusion that if a candidate is not doing well in the polls or doing well in fundraising or on the air with a lot of advertising, they're not credible. They're not worth covering. And more the news coverage really is kind of a coverage of the advertising. and the issues raised in the ads.
So there's a kind of chicken and egg here, Daniel Payne. You say the media is driving candidates to get on because, as Todd points out, they're covering the races less, so the candidates have to go out, spend the big money, get their ads up there. But what does it give us in terms of our impression of politicians when we learn about them by advertisement rather than by news coverage?
Well, it means that you get one-sided slams on both sides, that voters are sort of left with their hands up in the air. They don't know who to believe. The press has a role to play here to referee these disputes, to do the ad watches, which have been in vogue in the last 10 or 15 years. The problem with the ad watch, if we can just talk
about... This is where they look for the claims made in ads and say true, false, ambiguous.
Right. Now, TV stations occasionally do it, but mostly it's newspapers that dissect an ad and look at its accuracy and its factual basis. The problem with ad watches is they only affect a campaign one day. The commercials may continue to run
and run
over and over and over and over again, so it doesn't really damage a campaign that's
cheating. Right, and face it, the ad watches are kind of somewhere buried in the newspaper. The ads are right on television and often prime time.
Exactly. So a bad review by an ad watch editor isn't going to deter any campaign from continuing.
We've got a lot to talk about tonight, but we want to do it in the context of the ads that are running right across the country. There are races in this country so close that the ad spending has just been exorbitant. There are races so close that the ads have gotten pretty down and dirty. Let's turn first to the West Coast, to California, where Gray Davis, incumbent Democrat, is up against Bill Simon, Republican. And let's get one right out of the gate here, an ad favoring Gray Davis, and you'll hear him suggesting that Bill Simon will kill California business.
Is Bill Simon qualified to be governor? The savings and loan he directed went belly up, costing taxpayers millions. Another Simon company, Geologistics, lost millions more. His company, Hanover Compressor, partnered with Enron, used questionable accounting methods, and is under federal investigation. Simon's financial firm was fined for violations of securities rules. Simon, if he can't run a business, how can he run the fifth largest economy in the world?
And the message we hear, Bill Simon, scary loser. Todd Domke, you're the Republican consultant. Bill Simon's a Republican. Is this fair?
Well, I don't know. As far as fairness, I'm reminded of...
All's fair?
No, I'm reminded of something George Carlin said. He said, remember, dishonesty is the second best policy. And I'm afraid that is often the credo for a lot of these campaigns.
But here's the boogeyman tone, the claims of failure, right. Failure in business, and next he'll ruin in our state.
Well, I'm glad that our listeners have a chance to hear rather than see a television commercial, because they do, yes, see, I think, more clearly what's going on. They discern more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
The melancholy music and yet the ominous words. Mm-hmm. It's a combination where the emotions are really being appealed to at some basic level, where when you see the visuals, and whether it's, you know, news clips that they're showing or gray pictures.
It sounds like him crawling through the desert at night, starving.
Yes, but the tone is much of it. Now, what's interesting, because earlier I don't want to absolve the consultants who produce these commercials entirely by saying that the news media is all at fault. The fact is, they are guided by their polling, and what their polling reveals is that a negative spot is usually has more of an impact. Now, it can also backfire, but it has more of an impact. So voters need to ask themselves, wait a minute, if we just blame those producing these ads, why are they producing them? They're producing them because they're more effective in reaching us. What does that tell us about us? So I think if we're going to have some revolutionary change in raising the tone, it's got to be with voters seeing through a lot of this stuff.
What does it tell us about us, Daniel Payne, that we are quicker to write off positive claims and maybe believe negative claims?
Well, that's human nature. If I were to tell you something good about someone who walks in this room now, in 5 minutes you'd probably forget it and might not believe me. But if I were to whisper to you something nasty about that person, you might never forget it.
It sticks.
Yeah, campaigns, Todd's right, campaigns do this not just because it's effective, but because it gets retained by voters and viewers. I think the spot that we just heard is really about the anxiety and anger that voters felt toward CEOs, toward business executives.
In general, he was in business, and you know what business does to California, to everybody these days.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's get right back in and see how Bill Simon, Republican, responds, or at least what he puts on the air, to go after Gray Davis. And here are maids going through the governor's office, that is Gray Davis's office, and finding piles and piles of cash, but not much action.
Next, we do the governor's office.
What's this, Sue?
Oh, leave that be. That's how things work around here.
But why so much money?
That's Governor Davis. All he ever does is fundraise for his campaign.
Look at this.
Leave it be. I'm sure the governor will take care of it eventually.
It doesn't look like he's here much.
He spends most of his time at campaign fundraisers.
No wonder California has so many problems.
Oh, there goes the power again.
Oh, there goes that Gray Davis again. And you heard that little where the maid is blowing the dust off some kind of action plan. We don't know what. Well, if CEO has been a bad tag to lay at anybody, so has a big money politician. And here, Todd, it's laid right on Gray Davis.
It certainly is. The visuals are so important, of course, in humor in any television commercial. So we're missing much of it because it is funny. You do, again, pick up, though, on the music. The music sounds a little hokey. It's sort of this kind of, I don't know, almost circus music or whatever. But it's comedic music. And again, a lot of people aren't really aware of how crucial music is in the advertising, just like it is in a movie, and how much care goes into picking just the right kind of music. But in this case, it is, effective in mocking Gray Davis, and of course reminding people of the gray out, as they referred to the power outage.
The power outage. And here again, Dan, you've got the negative pushed at a kind of target that everybody understands. Politicians who spend all their time raising money, let's hang that on this governor.
Right. It's a cliche. It works on people's basic assumption that politicians raise money and spend it on themselves and ignore our problems. It's interesting, though, that funny commercials, and this one is a funny spot, frequently are done by campaigns that are trailing. And Bill Simon has been well behind Gray Davis in California for a very long time. And frequently, when you really have nothing to lose, you try humor.
Laugh so you don't cry. Let's scoot right down to Texas because we've got a lot to look at tonight. Here we go. We got Tony Sanchez, Democrat, up against Rick Perry for governor. Here's one that favors Tony Sanchez. It's a spoof on the MasterCard ads. You'll hear it.
Reeling in a 5-pound bass, priceless. Your baby girl's first ballet, priceless. Winning the championship in overtime, priceless. An appointment to chair the Public Utility Commission, $25,000. A veto of important health care legislation, $766,000. Allowing the highest insurance rates in the country, $1 million. There are some things money can't buy. For vetoes and other favors, there's Rick Perry.
Vetoes and other favors, and the needle screeches, and Rick Perry has it all hung on him, the Republican candidate, buys Tony Sanchez, Democrat. Dan Payne, fair, effective?
Clever spot. It's interesting that this technique, this satire of Visa or MasterCard, whichever one it is, was used by Ralph Nader when he ran for president a couple of years ago, and he got sued by the credit card company.
And they're right back using it. I have to admit, it passed me by a little bit. Maybe Texas has something going on that I don't fully understand here. Tom?
Well, it's obviously an issue that they're trying to make something out of something scandalous in terms of lobbying money or something. I don't know. But people should realize, by the way, that the idea of being sued for plagiarism or something. With political campaigns, they don't care. So, because they know that by the time a lawsuit,
sue me, I'll be gone.
There's no the money in the campaign treasury, and the politicians, the candidates, are protected by their First Amendment rights to say whatever they want.
And if I'm elected governor of Texas, you're probably not going to come after me, MasterCard or Visa.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And also, you welcome the publicity.
Right. Please, sue me. Put my name in the headline.
Exactly. Well, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Yeah.
Well, we're looking at right across the country at political ads. In the political ad season, you can join us. We're looking at the good, the bad, and the ugly of campaign ads 2002. What political ads on TV work for you? Which ones drive you crazy, get your attention, get your vote? And you've heard it. The pros say negative ads work. Do they work for you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the good, the bad, and the ugly of campaign ads. 2002, do the TV ads make you want to vote or turn you off on everybody? And if we have to have political ads on TV, what do you want to see and hear in those ads? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Dan Payne, president of Payne & Company, a Boston-based consulting company. He's a Democrat, helps Democrats win office. And Todd Domke, Republican media consultant, with us as well. We just heard an ad from Texas where Tony Sanchez was going after Rick Perry. It was negative. Here's a positive kind of homespun ad where Rick Perry says, hey, I've grown up kind of in the heart of Texas. Vote for me.
Five generations of Perrys been out here making a living from these red breaks. Sometimes it wasn't much of a living. Had a few bumper crops. Most of the time it was going from drought to drought. You know, Pink Creek's a pretty small community. You're not going to find it on many maps. But what you find are some values that are branded in my heart. Those same values that, quite frankly, have been here for decades, are serving me well today as the governor of the state of Texas.
Governor Perry, leadership, experience, vision.
Dan Payne, he's got values branded right here in his heart. Does that work? We've all seen the regional equivalent of this, the kind of, you know, just bales of hay and flannel shirts, and we're good folk, and I'm good folk, and you should vote for me. Does it work?
Well, I think it's a Texas cliche, or at least perhaps a Southwestern cliche.
Cliches often work.
They're a cliche for a reason. This felt very Texan. He looked Texan. He's running against a man named Sanchez. Maybe he's trying to send a message here that I'm a real Texan.
The salt of the earth.
Yeah. But I think it was interesting. That commercial works better. We saw it before we went on the air. And I don't think it was as good visually as it sounds here. It's actually a pretty interesting audio track.
Well, it's got that sound, Todd Domke, of the old Marlboro commercial here, sort of, you know, big sky country.
And visually, it had the look of it as well. Again, it shows the importance of the culture as far as what commercial works where, and perhaps I can't see a commercial like that working in Massachusetts, for example.
Well, but we've had, you know, the family.
That's true. We have our own cliches.
Yes,
that's true. But it points up back to what we were talking about, a positive versus negative, that in the positive commercial, one of the ways it's weaker is that there is less information given. Mm-hmm. Whereas on a negative commercial, they're trying to show how authentic and how factual and documented it all is. And the other thing is that with a positive commercial, it's harder to sustain. The more you see a commercial like that, the less impact it has, because then you're seeing through it. The music isn't working on you the way it did before.
So it's warm and fuzzy, but how much edge does it have? Todd, Dan, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now Kenneth Goldstein. He's director of the Wisconsin Advertising Project at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Good evening and welcome, Kenneth Goldstein.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
You bet.
Ken, you have looked at a lot of numbers. You've tracked ads right across the country from an enormous database of what's going on and looked at trends in this year compared to previous years. What does television campaign advertising look like in 2002, let's say to previous years, maybe to 2000?
Exactly. We've tracked advertising in the top 100 markets in this country, which comprises a little over 80% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is, comparing to 2000, that up until mid-September, the tone of ads in 2002 was more positive than during the exact same corresponding time period in 2000.
Mid-September, i.e., that is just about up to the 9/11 anniversary.
Exactly. Just up to the 9/11 anniversary, just after the 9/11 anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
After that, we've seen the tone of advertising in 2002 return to the same negative levels that we've seen in previous years. And in fact, it's exactly the same if you compare year-to-date or September 12th to October 30th, 31st
mm-hmm.
for 2002 to the exact same time period in 2000, the tone of advertising is exactly the same.
Can you run ratios on this? What is overall the ratio of positive to negative advertising on TV for this campaign season?
When you add negative ads and contrast ads, one thing we haven't talked about, that there's pure positive ads, there's pure negative ads, but what a lot of candidates do is have contrast ads, which are a little bit of both. But when push comes to shove, a contrast ad is really more about the other person than it is about you. We see about 40% of the ads in the country are positive ads this year.
40%?
40% since mid-September are positive.
And in some states, for example, New Jersey, positives get right down to 18%, if I'm correct.
Exactly.
I think we've got
some of the competitive Senate races. Competitive races draw negative advertising. So in the high-profile races that are drawing the highest volume of advertising, the Arkansas, the Colorados, the Missouris, New Hampshire, we're seeing almost uniformly negative messages going out.
I've got an ad here in your neighboring state, Minnesota, in the governor's race there. This one favors Tom Pawlenty, the Republican, who's up against Roger Moe, Democrat, and the independent Tim Penny. But I'd like to let's listen to this. We've got a kind of Batman and Robin theme. You tell me, Kenneth Goldstein, if this is negative or what you'd call a contrasting ad.
Taxman and Roger.
Increases.
Candidates Tim Penny and Roger Moe both favor tax increases. Tim Penny and Roger Moe, the dynamic tax-raising duo. Taxman and Roger, higher taxes. Only Tim Pawlenty won't raise your taxes. He'll be the taxpayer's hero, cutting wasteful spending and holding government accountable.
I'm the only candidate in this race who won't raise your taxes.
Corny and campy as can be, Tim Pawlenty wears a T-shirt at the end that's got something like a Batman symbol on the front of it. But do you call this a contrast ad, Kenneth Goldstein?
Yeah, I guess I'd first call it a bad ad, but then I would code it as a contrast ad. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's saying I won't raise your taxes; they will.
We've listened to a lot of ads here tonight, and they're interesting, they're good, and they make the point. But let me reiterate some of the general points that I think the guests have made previously. Overall, when you look at negative advertising, the evidence is very strong that negative advertisements have more information, are more factually correct, mm-hmm. and are better documented than positive ads.
So are they a sign of political health?
I'm actually someone who doesn't get too particularly concerned about mm-hmm. the volume of negative ads. Certainly, we can point to individual ads that are poorly done, and ultimately they're not going to move voters.
Right.
And certainly, we can point to ads which we think are over the top, which are mudslinging, and ultimately, with those, most of the time there's going to be a backlash, and they're not going to be effective. But in general, most negative ads are accurate, and most negative ads are documented. And then actually, when I've done work and others have done work that looks at the effectiveness of these ads or what voters learn from these ads, voters who are exposed to negative ads actually know more about the candidates.
So they're more informative, even though we gripe and moan about all the negative ads. Kenneth Goldstein, give us a sense of what's being talked about in television ads this year. What are the top issues? How do they stack up?
Shockingly, the top issues are Social Security, taxes, education, and health care. They're really the same issues that have been talked about in elections in the last number of years.
Shockingly, you're being facetious.
I'm being very facetious.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the issues that we would think of the day. Iraq's not getting talked about. 9/11's not getting talked about. Terrorism isn't getting talked about.
If I read your numbers correctly, only something like 2 or 3% of ads touch on terrorism.
Exactly, and very, very few ads are talking about Enron or talking about any of the corporate malfeasance that's happened.
I want to get a sense from our guests in the studio of how to interpret that. Todd, war on terror, Enron have been huge headlines. Why don't they show up in the ads? Why is it the evergreens? Is that what people really care about?
Well, because the terrorism and Enron and all that, really, usually, it's not a matter of contrast. You know, it's not as if one candidate is pro-terrorism.
We're all against Enron. We're all against terror.
Exactly. Right. The other ones, taxes, education, Social Security, prescription drugs, are all about direct self-interest appeals to voters. And a candidate's really in trouble if, for example, all the elderly thinks one candidate will help with prescription drugs mm-hmm. and the other won't. So that's about, hey, we can't concede that turf to them. So in many cases, they're doing kind of defensive work to try to say, hey, I'm okay on this issue. In other cases, they're trying to attack.
We do have one ad. This is from Colorado in the U.S. Senate race there, where Wayne Allard, Republican incumbent, is going up against Tom Strickland. This ad favors Allard, and it's I'm sorry. I've got that wrong. This is Doug Forrester. Gee, I've got that all backwards. This is New Jersey. Is that right? This is New Jersey we've got up next. It's the U.S. Senate, and there's Doug Forrester, Republican, is up against Frank Lautenberg, Democrat. And here is an attack on Lautenberg for being weak, maybe weak on war.
Why did Frank Lautenberg oppose a missile defense system to protect America? Why did Lautenberg vote to dramatically cut America's defense budget? Why did Lautenberg oppose attacking Saddam Hussein after he invaded Kuwait? And why does Lautenberg oppose the death penalty for terrorists who murder Americans? We may never know why, but with all that's on the line, why would we ever give Lautenberg the chance to do it again?
Kenneth Goldstein, here's a sort of choral requiem in the background and the litany of the ways in which Frank Lautenberg, Doug Forrester's ad says, has a record of not standing up to protect America. Why terror in this race?
I'm sorry, was that to me?
Yes, Kenneth, if you're there.
I'm sorry, yes. That the terror is one part of a number of messages that are going on, and listen, I think that's a fine example of a fair negative ad. Those are all documented votes that Frank Lautenberg made. Frank Lautenberg is certainly going to have the resources to go on the air and defend himself,
and certainly has.
And my understanding is there have not been a tremendous number of debates in New Jersey that the Lautenberg forces have agreed to. And normatively, that's a terrific ad in my book.
So put it out there. Kenneth Goldstein, how about the money that's being spent this year on television ads? How does it compare with past years?
Oh, it's going to be a record. We're going to have over $1 billion spent on television advertising this year. Just since the middle of September, we've had close to $400 million spent on political advertising. I think what some people forgot was, even though it's not a presidential year, we have so many competitive gubernatorial races, and those gubernatorial races are in big states with expensive markets, in Texas with Houston and Dallas, and in Pennsylvania, in New York, in California. And so,
overall, your bottom line, does all that money lead to a better informed electorate or a propagandized and disinformed electorate?
Listen, in a perfect world, would we like lots of debates and the ability of every politician to go to everyone's living room and have in-depth conversations on the issues? Sure. But that's simply not possible. The fact of the matter is that the way campaigns and candidates run in elections is through both paid media and free media. And like one of the guests said before, the free media simply doesn't cover politics very extensively. Doing another study of local news stations, and only 37% of all local news broadcasts in the top 50 markets in the last 6 weeks even had one political story.
Wow.
So
you've got to raise the money to get it out there.
You've got to raise the money to get on the air.
That's kind of a sorry comment on the state of news coverage, I must say. Dan Payne?
I think also this year we're seeing, and maybe Professor Goldstein can enlighten us on this if he's examined it, but a few years ago we were told that the Internet was going to revolutionize communication. Judging from the amount of money that's being spent on normal television spots, I would say the Internet is so far a failure.
Ken Goldstein, does it even show up? Is it a blip?
It's barely a blip. Candidates use it for logistical purposes, for organizing purposes, and sometimes for some fundraising purposes. But in terms of getting your message out and getting your message out to swing voters, it's not a major player at all.
It's all about TV. Kenneth Goldstein, thanks for joining us tonight, and keep up the good work there tracking everything going on.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. Kenneth Goldstein is director of the Wisconsin Advertising Project at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Let's get back to these ads because I just want to hear them. Here's from Colorado, U.S. Senate race, Wayne Allard this time, and Tom Strickland. Wayne Allard, Republican, incumbent, Tom Strickland, a Democrat. And here, the Allard ad goes after Tom Strickland. Wayne Allard is a good veterinarian. Tom Strickland is a lawyer.
Experience makes a difference. Wayne Allard is a veterinarian. Tom Strickland, a 17th Street lawyer. Senator Allard, elected to serve the public interest. Tom Strickland made millions lobbying for special interests. Senator Allard, a leader in the U.S. Senate. Tom Strickland, a Washington, D.C. lobbyist. Senator Wayne Allard, making a difference for Colorado. Lawyer Tom Strickland, a millionaire lobbyist who said he can't remember which corporations he represented. That's why experience makes a difference. U.S. Senator Wayne Allard.
Lawyer, 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 lawyer. Can't say it enough, Todd Domke. Is it enough to keep lawyer, lobbyist, lawyer, lobbyist? Does this work? Does it get branded on our minds in a way that sticks with us when we go to the polls?
Well, apparently it doesn't work since most of the people in Congress are lawyers,
yeah,
it seems.
I guess not, right.
But it does raise the question. Again, this is a contrast ad. Mm-hmm. It would feel to most voters who are supposedly turned off by the tone as a negative ad, but they do – it does sort of frame the choice a little for them. Mm-hmm. But the question then is, as pointed out by the professor earlier, that most of the negative ads are in the really hotly contested races.
Right.
So the real problem to me, as far as political health is concerned, mm-hmm. is the fact that there aren't many competitive races. There's not much of a choice for most
people. That's the big story here.
And why is that? And so the negative...
Well, we know it's because the districts have been gerrymandered to keep incumbents in office.
But not in the U.S. Senate races. It doesn't
explain
that.
True.
The governors. So, in other words, the incumbents, they're the ones running all the positive ads because they just want to pretend like there's no choice. There's nothing. There's no contrast. They don't want the voters to be thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So voters should instead remember what Jefferson said. Jefferson said we need a revolution every 20 years. Now, this is a bloodless revolution when you're talking about negative advertising and getting all juiced up before an election and heated rhetoric
whatever.
We need to stir things up. We need
wave
to
wave the bloody shirt, the torches.
We need to raise the questions about incumbents, put them on the spot.
Let's bring some callers in. Charles is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I just wanted to say that I would have normally voted for Doyle. I'm a Democrat. And the tone...
They're in Wisconsin, Charles.
Mm-hmm. Yes, here in Wisconsin.
Yep.
I would have voted for Doyle normally. I voted for him in the primary. And the entire advertising blitz of just negative campaigning has just turned my stomach. And now I am not going to vote for either Doyle or McCallum. I'm going to vote for an independent candidate, Ed Thompson, because it's just... I've talked to a lot of people here in Wisconsin. And it's just been.
And you say too negative, too much mud, and I'm out of that big two-party race. Charles, thanks for your call because it raises a really interesting subject of what percentage of the population just has such distaste for this kind of political dialogue carried out on air that they either check out completely and don't go to the polls, or they end up in the lap of a Green Party candidate, an independent candidate, Dan Payne. Is it possible that major party politicians know they're driving some voters away and don't mind because they
sure.
know the faithful will show up?
Sure. I think that's, if it isn't explicit, it's implicit in a lot of the strategies on TV to muddy the debate, to make it difficult for people to make an informed decision, and to address...
Even to turn people off to the system?
Well, I think they don't care whether people are clear or confused in their thinking about a race. But the caller touched on something that I think is important, which is why do these things work? They work, I think, in part because, as we've said before, they provide information, the negative spots I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they work because voters and viewers already bring to this a deep cynicism about politics
mm-hmm.
and politicians. And they are fully prepared to believe the worst of just about anybody.
And that's already baked in the cake.
Yeah. And I have one more thing to say about positive versus negative. The dirty little secret of this business is that the toughest commercial to make in a campaign is a compelling positive spot. Any mm-hmm. fool can make a negative commercial. Mm-hmm. It takes a skilled practitioner to do a good positive.
It's tougher. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about the good, bad, and ugly of campaign ads 2002. Do these ads work even when they make you a little sick? Do the images influence you even if you don't like them? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the good, the bad, and the ugly nationally of campaign ads 2002. My guests tonight are two political consultants. From the Democratic side, Dan Payne, president of Payne & Company, a Boston-based consulting agency. And from the Republican side, Todd Domke, also a media consultant, strategist, and ad man for dozens of campaigns around the country. You can join us as well. How is the world of television political ads shaping our political conversation? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. And we want to hear some more of these ads. Let's go right down to North Carolina, where the wife of the man with Viagra, Elizabeth Dole, is running for office, and she's not talking about that. She's talking about her 101-year-old mother. Let's listen.
Mother and I talk every day. She lives with me here in Salisbury.
We talk about family affairs. That's important to her. Old friend.
Mother's 101, so we talk a lot about doctors and prescription drugs. I know why it's so important to talk to doctors, not bureaucrats, and why we need a Medicare prescription drug benefit.
Mothers know best.
Mother is 101, and we're still not going to let her off the hook for joining us in a campaign ad. Is this effective? We see the visual is Elizabeth Thole right there next to her 100-year-old mom sitting cheek to cheek.
Well, I don't know if North Carolinians take her at face value when she says that she talks to her mother every day and she lives with her, because she knows, they know that the candidate is out on the campaign trail campaigning, and I'm sure they don't want the mother at 101 to be in tow having to go through her paces.
Still, there they are at home, and prescription drugs rates high in the list of issues, Dan Payne.
Yeah, the problem with this, you can't see it. So you don't realize it, is that the mother looks extremely frail. She looks like
she
barely get through this commercial. So there's an element
that
of
ambitious daughter keeps pushing her up on stage.
There's a feeling of exploitation somehow that comes across in this.
Speaking of families called out, here in Minnesota is the Republican candidate Norm Coleman, who's up against, for Senate, up against now Walter Mondale, in an ad that puts his daughter front and center.
Hi, it's me again. I thought of something else that I wanted to tell you about my dad. I told you he's smart, he's nice, and when he says he's going to do something, he does it. If he says we're getting ice cream, he doesn't stop until we get it. If he says we're bringing hockey back, he doesn't stop until we get it. He's like that all the time. But you know the best thing about my dad? He's got a really good heart. I just thought you should know.
You can't get much sweeter, and neither can you get than the totally cute face and voice of this girl. Is there a better endorsement for a dad than a daughter?
No, I don't think so. This girl was adorable. I mean, it was obviously very genuine. I mean, this is not scripted.
You see can't script a 9-year-old sitting on the front steps.
No, they obviously interviewed her and then edited the best stuff out of this. But the truth is, she is so much more telegenic than her father as a candidate. If she were the candidate, and I think she's a few years shy
like
of the required age,
right,
she would be beating Walter Mondale in the polls.
If you average her age against Elizabeth Dole's mother, you'd have the ideal age.
And yet I've got to say, watching this with the two of you before the show, to me, this was working. I mean, a daughter who can look at you with those clear eyes and put all these positive sentiments out there about the father, it looks like a more honest endorsement than any other politician or interest group you can imagine.
Well, Norm Coleman has one of the toughest assignments in politics, to campaign with his head held high when the candidate thought he was opposing died.
Mm-hmm. There's Paul Wellstone last Friday.
So he needed to do something just to get him over that period of mourning. And I think the commercial is effective. It's effective in that it gives another dimension to Coleman's candidacy, but I don't know whether it's going to allow him to beat Walter Mondale in a general election.
Josh is on the line. Welcome, Josh. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
You were talking about music as a backdrop to these commercials.
Yes.
And I live in the greater Boston area and have to watch all these New Hampshire commercials for candidates I don't even have to vote for.
Oh, they slosh right over that border, don't they?
And so I don't even know who she's running against, but there's an attack ad against Martha Fuller Clark that shows Martha marching down the street, and it says, "Here comes Martha," and there's fat music playing in the background.
What is fat music, Josh?
Fat music, just like this. Boom, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum.
It's elephants on parade.
Elephants at the circus.
It seems like some sort of subliminal personal attack to me. You couldn't get away with saying, "Here comes Big Fat Martha," but the music is sort of saying that.
Sticks and stones and music that makes fun. Josh, thanks for the image, I guess. Todd Domke, is this below the belt or just standard?
Well, it's not even subliminal. I think anyone seeing that knows what's going on, because the footage of her walking in a parade and with the circus-like music, it does bring to mind, let's say, people who are less than nimble-footed, and it's not flattering. So she then has responded, though, with a commercial making fun of her opponent by then doing some creative editing with him walking down the steps to make it look like he's dancing and trying to answer in kind.
So everybody has their fun. Adam is on the line. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Well, thanks.
You guys have just come right back to what I wanted to touch on, which is that the music and the increasingly visceral nature of all the political ads.
Mm-hmm.
Someone made a comment right before your break that it's pretty easy to make a good negative ad, but it's pretty difficult to make a good positive ad.
Now, we heard Norm Coleman do it with his daughter, but yeah.
But that's just it, is that it's purely visceral.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course his daughter loves him. And, I see ads like that. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, That tells me zero.
We're talking about affairs of state and issues of the nation here. Right, right.
And so what I'm sort of saying is, I hesitate to use such a hackneyed phrase, but the dumbing down even of political commercials, because that doesn't tell me anything, and neither does My Opponent Is the Devil with the Sting music behind it and, you know, the fade-outs. And it's just sort of like, okay, well, clearly you don't like your opponent, but again, I don't know anything about you, and I'm very hesitant to take your word for anything about your opponent.
Adam, we've got it. And this dumbing down issue, thanks for your call, Adam. I want to put this to both of you. Where are these ads taking us in general, Dan Payne? Is it dumbing down? Is it just putting the full, all of our emotions and intellect to work, or is intellect left out of it?
I think it's the latter. I think campaigns are run these days on the basis of visuals and music and overall impressions and information that might get through in on an attack spot or whatever are less important and are retained for a shorter period of time than an attempt at a positive message or an uplifting message. There was a time in American politics back when it first became fashionable to use TV to do things that were visually very almost loving. Robert mm-hmm. Kennedy walking on a beach, mm-hmm. Candidates on the seashore really talking about their interest in protecting our land and water. These things would be laughed out of existence in modern campaigns.
Todd Domke, Republican consultant, last word goes to you. How are we doing here? The political health, give us your thumbs up, thumbs down, in between.
Well, I think part of the problem is the televisionization of politics leads to it being more personal as well as more vicious. As candidates listen to their pollsters and say, oh, we've got to find the middle ground. We don't want to alienate anyone. And what they say becomes more mushy. Mm-hmm. Then the character issue, The personal kind of contrast.
So if we're all going to cluster around the same positions, then
character
we've got to slash
becomes
at
more
character.
Important, and mm-hmm. then it becomes more personal in the attacks as well as in the puff piece.
So in a way, in the old days when party lines were drawn a bit farther apart, there was more room to go straight at the issues.
Then the issue seemed to matter more. More was at stake, and there was more interest.
Well, and in between, we've heard tonight a lot of what we had. It was a fun tour. Thank you to both of you for coming in. Dan Payne, president of Payne & Company, a Boston-based consulting agency, and Todd Domke, strategist and ad man for dozens of campaigns around the country, author most recently of Cain and Abel at Work and the Conservative's Dictionary, Witty Wicked Definitions to Drive Liberals Wild. Well, we're wild. Thanks to both of you for being in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, a jazz standard turns 75. Of Halloween morning, 1927, a then fairly unknown Hoagy Carmichael walked into Gannett Records in Richmond, Indiana, to record what would become one of his greatest hits, Stardust. Today, Stardust has become one of the most performed songs in jazz, recorded at least 500 times, with its lyrics translated into 40 languages. We spoke with Will Friedwald, author of Stardust Melodies, about the story of Stardust and how it became such a popular jazz standard.
Writing of Stardust, the lyric is a very accurate depiction of the kind of mythology that Hoagy Carmichael, the composer, wanted people to know about the song. The lyric is basically a guy contemplating the starry night and thinking about lost loves, kind of a song with built-in nostalgia. And that's always the story that Hoagy himself wanted to be told about the song, that he was visiting his alma mater, and he was contemplating a starry night, and he was looking up at the starscape and thinking about his college days and his lost loves, and all of a sudden this melody hit him, and a friend of his came up with the title Stardust. When they heard the melody, it said it sounded like dust falling from the stars. The thing is that that's always sort of been the mythology, and the truth is that Hoagy might have been working on the song for a number of years, even before he came back to his Indiana University, so it's certainly something he wanted people to know, and certainly something he wanted people to think, but in actuality, the song may be older than that. those days, almost everything was a very snappy, peppy, fast tempo. And even Stardust, which he intended to be a ballad, but in those days a ballad was pretty fast, particularly in the jazz world where you would dance to it. And it wasn't until the lyric was added around 1930, then it became really clear that the song was a love song, and it really becomes identified as a love song. And the one that really solidified the song's stature among jazz musicians was the great one from 1931 by Louis Armstrong. The Armstrong version has got a beautiful trumpet solo and one of the all-time great jazz vocals. It's just a very definitive early masterpiece version of Stardust, and pretty much codified the song as a great vehicle for jazz musicians over the years.
A barren where roses bloom, though I dream in vain. Oh, in my heart, it will remain, baby. My Stardust melody, oh memory, oh memory, oh memory.
Once it was recognized as a ballad, it had this ongoing identity with the jazz world. In fact, it was considered sort of like Tiger Rag or St. Louis Blues. It was sort of considered a piece that jazz musicians considered their own. And one of the major things that's happened to the song over the years is it's been getting slower and slower. I mean, ever more celestial, ever more stardusty. And when you hear the later versions of it, the later treatments of it from the 50s and 60s, by that point, you know, they've pretty much given up the idea that this is a piece of material that began in the jazz world. And by that point, they're treating it pretty much exclusively as a very slow, very romantic ballad. I mean, the most famous later version of it is the Nat Cole Gordon Jenkins treatment from 1956, which is very slow, very magisterial, and very romantic, very sentimental, with heavy strings, and just beautiful.
And I am once again with you, when our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. But that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song.
I think that Stardust has all the characteristics of a great song. The way it's put together, it's in such a challenging way, and particularly in terms of the melody. It's a very engaging melody, and the harmonies are very strong. It's a very sophisticated song. And like most of the great songs, it's a song that really works well in lots of different interpretations. It's existed as a fast song, it's existed as a slow song. It's not specific to any kind of given instrumentation. You could play it as a tenor solo, or you could play it with, you know, 9,000 strings. But also the content of the lyric is very important in that it never quite exactly lays out what's going on. I mean, there's a quality of mystery about it. I mean, a guy talks about reminiscing about his past loves and life, and he never quite comes out and says exactly what it is that he's talking about. I mean, exactly what happened in this relationship. And I think it's still intriguing. I mean, it still tells a story that still seems relevant. I mean, in a way, unless people stop having relationships, and as long as they do, you know, this song is still going to be valid. It's still going to have something to say to us.
Will Friedwald is author of Stardust Melodies. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBUR. We're funded by...